Is Baltimore funny? It's all relative, says our next guest on Midday. What someone might find funny about Baltimore or in Baltimore would likely be lost on someone in Denver or L.A. Psychologist Peter McGraw and journalist Joel Warner conducted semi-serious national and international research to find out what makes things funny. Joel Warner joins us this hour to tell us what they learned. And we'll hear about an algorithm Peter McGraw developed to rank the 50 funniest cities in America, what the psychologist claims to be the most comprehensive analysis of humorous cities ever attempted. Cracking the Humor Code, a global search for what makes things funny, with Joel Warner after the news. So this guy goes to the dentist. He says, "Hey, doc, I got yellow teeth." Dentist says, "Well, wear a brown tie." You like that? Okay, let me try this one. So two hunters are out in the woods, and one of them collapses. He doesn't seem to be breathing, and his eyes are glazed. The other guy whips out his cell phone, calls 911. "My friend is dead. What can I do?" The dispatcher says, "Calm down. I can help. First, let's make sure he's dead." But then you hear a gunshot. Guy comes back on the phone and says, "Okay, now what?" In a 2002 survey conducted by British researchers, that joke was found to have the widest appeal across the globe and was proclaimed to be the world's funniest joke. I like my Annie Youngman yellow teeth brown tie thing. Okay, but anyway. But what is funny? Huh? Talk about something subjective. Comedians, psychologists, philosophers, sociologists, they've all attempted to figure out what makes people laugh and why. Freud believed it was the release of pent-up thoughts and emotions. But for people who examine humor, people actually study this, study humor, none of these explanations have been sufficient to cover all forms of funny. There's slapstick, there's dirty jokes, there's tickling, there's puns, there's talking animals in TV ads. I love the gecko guy. Anyway, our guest this hour is Joel Warner, co-author of a book called The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. He and his co-author, psychologist Peter McGraw, sought to discover if there was a universal sense of humor that all humans share, if humor really is the best medicine, and if humor can exist in the harshest of realities. Warner and McGraw brought laughter to impoverished areas of the Peruvian Amazon with 100 clowns. They traveled to Tanzania to study the validity of a laughing epidemic that broke out in 1962. And along the way, they spent time in the Middle East to see if, in the face of difficult hardships, one can still maintain a sense of humor. They spoke with the Danish cartoonist whose satirical depictions of the Prophet Muhammad in 2008 sparked violent reactions from Muslims and caused the cartoonist to require a 24-hour security detail. And they examined whether truly hilarious people are also the saddest. Venturing to Los Angeles, the L.A., a laugh factory, they found that the comedy club hosted therapy nights in which the comedians talked to a psychologist while lying on a couch once owned by Groucho Marx. Groucho Marx. "I shot an elephant in my pajamas. What he was doing in my pajamas, I'll never know." Well, anyway, from the boozy humor of inebriated ad executives in New York to tender moments like the clown healing session for a man suffering with Parkinson's disease, these authors maintained a sense of humor and found that their explorations had in return made them funnier as well. So chance today to talk to Joel Warner, half of this team of Joel Warner and Peter McGraw, about their book, The Humor Code, which is published by Simon & Schuster. Peter McGraw is a professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado Boulder. We have his colleague with us today, Joel Warner, who's a journalist. Joel, thanks for joining us here on Midday on WYPR.
Thanks for having me, Dan. That was quite the intro.
Hey, you liked that?
I did.
Did it make you laugh a little bit?
Of course it did.
Huh?
I can still laugh at jokes even after deconstructing humor for a few years.
A little song, a little dance, a little seltzer on your pants, right?
Exactly.
I'm sorry, there's going to be a lot of this during this hour. I hope you're prepared. I can't help myself, really. But let me ask you how you and Peter came together. And I just want to mention to our listeners that you're welcome to join us here during this hour of the show to talk about this a little bit, what you find funny, what's not funny. And my question, is Baltimore funny? because we're going to find out during this hour that McGraw and Warner have this formula for trying to figure out an algorithm, actually. See, I love to use that word algorithm. I have no idea really what it means, but I just like to say it on public radio, and I sound smart. Anyway, so
sounds
it sounds good. They have an algorithm for figuring out which city is funny and which isn't. So we'll get into that in a little bit here. But first of all, Joel, how did you and Peter get together?
Well, it began a few years ago when I was a staff writer at Westword Newspaper, which was the alternative newspaper here in Denver, Colorado, looking for a new story, and I came across a reference to a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder who had a humor research lab, which he also referred to as HURL.
Did he have grants for this lab?
He has received some funding, not a lot of taxpayer funding, which I think is important to know because some people might get upset about using taxpayer money to look into what makes things funny. But he's been running these experiments, these peer-reviewed experiments that get into some of the top journals looking at what makes things funny. And so I started working on a story about this guy, and he has this theory of what makes things funny, kind of a new venture in the long, millennia-long attempt to figure out what makes things funny. And I was working on the story. I said to him, you know, this all sounds great. The experiments are fascinating. But I want to see your theory in action. How about you take your ideas about humor and I take you to a comedy club and you use your theory to critique the comedian? And without missing a beat, he says, how about I get up on stage myself and try stand up? And I said, yes. And so, of course, I took him to the hardest stand-up club in Denver, because that's what you do, right?
Right.
And this is a place that folks practice for months before they get up on stage. Pete, the professor, probably spent a few hours and then got up on stage wearing a sweater vest and tried his best to come up
with a joke. Well, let me ask you something about Peter McGraw and his theory before we go on here. Marketing specialist, right? Marketing and psychology are his field. So he has these labs to determine what makes people laugh, what people find funny for marketing purpose. Who funds his lab? I mean, are they advertising companies, for instance, marketing companies looking for using humor to sell something?
Well, he more plays in the field of behavioral economics, which is the red hot field of trying to figure out why people behave irrationally in their daily lives, why we don't just spend money by just purely weighing the values and the risks. So we all have our foibles in how we act our daily lives. And he came to believe that the most irrational concept of all is humor. So that's why I said, okay, I want to figure this out, not just purely for advertising and marketing reasons, but to understand how this impacts us in our daily lives.
Okay. So I think before we get to the results from Peter McGraw's stand-up routine, we ought to describe his theory a little bit, Joel.
Sure.
So I'll give our listeners the name of the theory, and then you take your time and explain it, all right?
Sounds good.
Peter McGraw's theory is called the benign violation theory, or the BNT. BVT, excuse me. The benign violation theory of humor goes like this. Take it away, Joel Warner.
The idea is that humor only arises when something appears to be a violation or somehow wrong, while simultaneously appears benign or somehow okay. Now, this can be moral violations, social violations, linguistic violations, you're talking about puns, or the example I like to give, because it's the part of humor that stumped many of the scholars who looked into it, including, say, Plato and Aristotle, is tickling. If you think about tickling, it's a physical violation. But you're not going to laugh if you tickle yourself because there's no violation there. At the same time, if you're walking down the street and some creepy guy comes up to you and tries to tickle you, you're not going to laugh, most likely.
No, no.
Nothing but that's benign.
I'm going to call 911.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you have to hit that.
Okay, so the word violation there, when it comes to, I understand it with tickling, okay? There's a physical thing going on there. I understand that. Playful fighting or tickling, it can be, it makes you laugh. Okay, But what about humor, you know, in rhetoric? What about, you know, funny prose? How does that constitute violation? Or are we challenging some, are we speaking about things that are taboo? Are we challenging something people believe, a myth? What's going on? The word violation, help me with that.
It's basically just, violation can be just a break from what you expect in some ways. You know, if you think about funny prose or the types of linguistic violations, it's basically, it's a break from either the grammatical structure that you expect or the topical structure that you expect to happen. At the same time, if it completely makes no sense, if you start, you know, saying words in different language, there's such a extreme violation, you know, nothing about that will be benign or okay. It won't make sense or it won't be funny.
Okay. Listen, we need to take a break here for two reasons. One, because it's time to take a break, but also, maybe we can get a better phone line with Joel. We'll try to do it. Joel, so we're going to take a break here. We'll come back and talk some more about your book, The Humor Code, co-written with Peter McGraw. And let me ask my listeners this. 410-662-8780. Are some cities funnier than others? Have you traveled to places where you felt like the people here have a sense of humor? Or this place is funny. This place is ridiculously funny. Can a place be funny? Is Baltimore funny? Is Glen Burnie funny? I like to say Glen Burnie. I like Glen Burnie. Is Dundalk funny? People have said Dundalk's been funny for years. I think it has to do with the name Dundalk. It's just kind of a funny name. Like cucumber. Like broccoli. Nectarine. Nectarine is funny. Avocado I find kind of funny. Why the pit is so big, I still don't understand. But anyway, take that up with God someday. 410-662-8780. The toll-free long-distance number is 866-661-9309. And midday email address. Want to send me a joke, a nice clean joke I can read on the air? We can make this the joke hour. You know what I mean? At midday at wypr.org. Okay, I got the first joke. First joke came in from Jeff by email. Here's the joke that I had my sons tell when they were young, around 4 years old. Well, that's good, Jeff. That's about the level we want here on a midday show. Why don't cannibals eat clowns? Because they taste funny. Bada bing. It's all in the delivery, especially from your four-year-olds. When I was 4 or 5 years old, I remember my friend Bobby Filbert gave me a joke to tell, and I didn't realize it was a dirty joke. I had no clue. So the next time my parents have their friends over for dinner, you know, they're all telling jokes. So I figured I'd tell this joke that Bobby Filbert told me to tell. I must have been about 6 years old. And they howled, and my father wanted to slap me because I can't repeat it on the air. But I was just 6 years old. We're talking about humor in this hour of the show. It's occasioned by the publication of a book called The Humor Code, written by Peter McGraw, who's a PhD in psychology and marketing, and Joel Warner, a journalist. They've collaborated on this book and actually traveled around the world studying humor. Is that correct, Joel? Oh, Joel, are you there?
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
I'm here.
Did you hear my question?
No, I'm not. Sorry, one more time.
Wow. Joel, are you there?
I am here. Sorry.
We're on the radio, Joel. It's WYPR Baltimore.
Yes.
You there?
Yes.
Okay. You and Peter actually traveled around the world.
Yes, we did. That's the thing. After Pete's not too successful attempt at stand-up in Denver, we decided he had a lot to learn about humor in the real world.
Okay. So where did you go?
So we went everywhere from Los Angeles to look at how and why people become funny, stand-up comedians, to New York, to the New Yorker cartoon process, to look at how we create humor, how we create, say, the New Yorker cartoons, to Tanzania, to look at laughter, why laughter seems to be something different from purely humor, to then we went to Japan, Palestine, Denmark, and Sweden, the heart of the Amazon with Patch Adams, the 100 Hospital Clowns.
Tell us about the clown thing, would you? Can we talk about clowns for a minute? Some people are aghast.
I don't want to talk about clowns.
Some people don't like clowns. They get a bad reaction to clowns. I hear things. I've heard people say that.
So we went there to look at this concept of laughter is the best medicine. We wanted to look at this from a scientific perspective. Can humor really help people heal? And so we basically invited ourselves to tag along with Patch Adams and 100 hospital clowns in the clown version of basically a Navy SEAL team expedition into the heart of the Amazon. And to be honest with you, we weren't looking forward to it. The idea of hanging out in the jungle for several weeks with 100 clowns didn't seem like us to be too much fun.
Did you actually do it?
Yeah, we actually flew in a Peruvian Air Force cargo plane into the heart of the Amazon. Literally, the cargo plane was packed with clowns, and we had to clown ourselves.
And what were the results of this research?
In some ways, for me, it ended up being our favorite trip, in part because I was so surprised by the outcome. It actually was both an incredibly enjoyable and incredibly powerful trip for me. In some ways, I had to walk the talk on this trip. I had to actually use what we'd been learning, because I said, hey, you have to clown yourself. And so we found that, no, scientifically, humor is not going to cure all these diseases. Unfortunately, a lot of the claims that have been put out about what humor can do for health haven't held up to scientific scrutiny yet. But one thing that has been proven, and we definitely saw this in the Amazon, is that humor does help you cope, both physically and emotionally. And so even though it was theoretically an unpleasant experience for us, being there, clowning in the middle of the jungle, the humor really helped make it enjoyable.
Now, I wonder if you have an observation about this. I think of clown, I use the word contrived, sort of contrived humor. You see a clown, you're supposed to laugh. A clown's supposed to be funny. And maybe you're not in the mood for funny. Or you go to a comedy club. People go to comedy clubs to be entertained, to laugh. It's still, it's performance, right? Whereas a lot of times we just laugh over something that's spontaneous. It happens in a hallway at work. It happens at home. It happens in the backyard, right? I'm not sure. Some people want to sit down and be presented with humor. And that's what gets me back to clowns. So I just wonder if you have an observation about contrived humor, attempted humor, versus humor that just kind of happens spontaneously.
From what evolutionary theorists believe, clearly the spontaneous humor came first. You know, the laughter about stumbling, or the laughter that we kind of share in this organic way in our daily lives, that came first. And then we kind of created this mass-produced comedy, this contrived humor. Both come theoretically from the same place. There's observation that something is a violation. Something happened that wasn't expecting, but it's okay. At the same time, what's interesting is that we looked at this concept of why humor seems to vary so much from place to place, based on politics or gender, or culture, whatever. So we went to Japan because we thought that would be the most different kind of humor imaginable. And the contrived humor, the mass-produced comedy. We went and sat in on these Japanese game shows. We went and sat in on the mandatory comedy training schools you have to go to if you want to be a Japanese comedian.
Yeah.
That humor, that comedy was very different than what we were used to. So you do see this variation in humor. However, then when we went and sat in the green room with these comedians on these crazy Japanese game shows, and our translator wandered off and we couldn't speak the same language, within 2 minutes we were cracking up over rude hand gestures and body humor, because that is less contrived. That's more organic. That's more human. And we all share in that. We all share the same understanding of rude body humor or complaints about mother-in-laws, or whacking our head on a door frame. So in some ways, while the contrived humor might end up making people more money in terms of TV shows and radio shows and magazines, the more universal stuff is the more simple humor,
right,
and not contrived.
Right. We're speaking with Joel Warner, with psychologist Peter McGraw, co-author of The Humor Code, talking about their, it really sounds like adventures as much as research, international research, to find out what makes things funny. The Humor Code, a global search for what makes things funny, is published by Simon & Schuster. 410 662-8780 is our phone number here. If you want to share a joke with us, an observation about what you find funny or what others find funny, or perhaps you've done some traveling around the world and run into this, you know, different cultures, the different things that are considered funny in different parts of the world. And also, when it gets to cities, I hope we have a chance to talk about that, Joel, this algorithm that Peter developed for determining which cities are funniest and where Baltimore fits in. 410-662-8780. Let's take a call from one of our listeners. This is Ed in Parkville. Ed, you're on with Joel Warner. Welcome to Midday.
8780. Let's take a call from
one of our... Ed, you got to turn the phone down. Geez, I haven't had to say that for a while. Most of our listeners are pretty well trained in that. So maybe if Ed comes back to the phone, we can get him on the air with us. But
hello.
Yes, Ed, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, just a note to Ed and other listeners. You know, when you get on the line to be with us, I can come to you at any time, and I'm glad you're calling in. But try to listen through your phone to the show and not on the air. So
the time either, yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ed.
Yeah. Well, my whole personality is a time delay. That's a joke.
Okay. Okay, go ahead, Ed.
So I got two questions. What makes for the difference in humor around the world, like German
humor?
You know, different parts of the world have different kinds of humor.
Yeah.
And the other thing I was curious about is why, when you're depressed, are you not funny and you don't jokes fun?
And you don't. And you don't what, Ed? You don't what?
You lose your sense of humor when you get depressed.
Well, yeah, you think? I mean, when you Joel, I know
I'm not as funny, and I don't think things are funny.
Yeah, I think that goes with being depressed. But Joel, this is a good opportunity to talk about how people use humor. People who are facing tough situations in life use humor. What did you and Peter discover there?
Yeah. It makes complete sense. When you are facing tough times, it's much harder to go to a place of laughs, to use humor. Yeah. At the same time, it's not as if that humor necessarily disappears. We spent a whole chapter looking at this concept of why and how you can find humor in these tough times. But we actually went to Palestine. We went to the West Bank, somewhere where folks said, oh, well, you know, you're not going to find a lot of humor there. You're not going to find a lot of laughs. We found it everywhere. We found they have comedians making jokes about getting on a plane in Israel and seeing the bathrooms that said occupied. So Palestinians say they've even occupied the bathroom. And we found a political satire show like Saturday Night Live that was on Palestinian state television, and it was huge. It was the most popular show, and they made fun of everything and everybody, because when you have so much potentially bad stuff going on, so many violations around you, and clearly, whatever you think about Palestine, Israel, you can say there are a lot of violations going on in Palestine. You can find ways to make those benign. It can take some work, but if you do, it's like you have dismantled these potentially troubling things. By stepping outside, thinking like a comedian, you've kind of made these things that you've been worrying about or upset about less threatening. You can laugh in the face of these problems. And that can be really, really helpful.
Yes. And that's, I would assume that's kindred to dark humor, what we call dark humor.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most extreme examples of this, of course, is gallows humor.
Mm-hmm.
Something that Freud talked about, this idea that, you know, if you can laugh in the face of what's the darkest concept of all, which is death, you've in some ways kind of removed its teeth.
Joel, let me ask you about crude humor, really crude humor, which seems to be the thing these days. What about that? Is that just a phenomenon that has to do with our changing standards in the society, or am I sounding like an old guy here today? Maybe a generational thing where different generations see things as funny and are pushing the extremes, pushing the envelope on what's funny in terms of you know, what's considered crude in humor?
Well, I don't know about that, because it might seem like humor is getting more and more crude, but if you look at the history of comedy, and there's a couple fantastic public archives of joke books that go back centuries, humor has always had this crude aspect. Just go back to the dead baby joke cycle, which started in the 60s and 70s, which are these really almost horrific jokes that are about dead babies. Mm. I mean, you could say those as crude as imaginable, but what the scholars believe is like it's almost a way for society to find a release valve for things they're worrying about. So this concept that they believe, say you look at these dead baby jokes, it's a way to society to deal with its concerns about the technological world and the fears about the danger for these new appliances and these new kind of modern concepts for the family.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that we can necessarily talk about freely in society, but if we can make jokes about it, that might be slightly more okay, because we could say, hey, it's just a joke, right?
Well, let's talk about McGraw's theory then, benign violation theory. Let's go back to that. The conditions are three here. One, a situation is a violation. So you're talking about a taboo subject or something that's considered so crude you wouldn't discuss it in public. The situation is benign, and both perceptions occur simultaneously. So that benign part has to be there, or else it doesn't work.
Yes, and that's why I think crude jokes can be difficult. A lot of people will not find them funny.
Mm-hmm.
Majority of people will say that just goes way too far.
Right.
Now, for some people who are okay with these jokes, who know it's just a joke, they might enjoy those crude jokes more than, say, a more benign joke, a more kind of, you know, an easier, let's say, cartoon that you read in the newspaper or whatnot, because there's something potentially about laughing at these potentially extreme things that may be really enjoyable for people.
Apparently so. Let's take a couple of calls, Joel, while you're with us. Joel Warner, the book is The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. Joel Warner with Peter McGraw on this. Michael in Baltimore, thank you for calling Midday. Go right ahead.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Good.
I guess my concern is with, I'm a Baltimore City teacher, middle school teacher, and I've noticed that not so much crude. I actually enjoy crude humor, and I think it goes a long way with people. My concern is more with children finding amusement in other people's pain. So if you notice kids watching YouTube videos, they're always watching like people getting hurt, and they think it's hilarious. And I think that in the current generation, the intellectual side of humor is dying out.
Hmm. Okay, let's hear from Joel about that. I'm thinking of this takes us to slapstick, maybe, although there does seem to be more pain in some of the videos that we see online. Go right ahead, Joel.
Well, Dan, I think as you point out, slapstick has been around forever. It's probably the first example of humor where, you know, our ancient ancestors, you know, stumbling on a rock and someone laughing at it. So, mm-hmm. So slapstick isn't new. One challenge these days is that thanks to the internet, thanks to YouTube or Facebook or whatnot, it's much easier to distribute all these examples of humor. You know, there's no gatekeeper who says what goes viral and what doesn't. On one hand, that might be a good thing, the fact that all of a sudden we might find these kind of comedic diamonds in the rough. At the same time, we might also see these more extreme attempts at humor. You know, someone, say, you know, jumping off their roof into, you know, a mattress thinking it's going to be funny, but it's actually quite dangerous. So you might see folks distributing these more extreme examples of slapstick.
Let me ask you about this notion. Laughter is infectious. Humor is infectious. If I start laughing, everybody else in the room will start giggling and laughing. Maybe. Depends on the room. But anyway, what about that? Is laughter and humor infectious? And did you and your colleague actually establish whether there had been a laughter epidemic in Tanzania?
So we went to Tanzania because we'd heard accounts of this laughter epidemic you mentioned, which is 1962, in what was then known as Tanganyika, three schoolgirls started laughing at a boarding school, and it spread to their classmates and the other classes. And the school just shut down, but it spread to other schools and other villages. And after several months, more than 1,000 people had apparently come down with this laughing disease, or as the locals called it, omnipo. And we went there, and sure enough, this really did seem to happen. We found folks who even experienced it, and they spoke to us. Now, the question is, what if anything that has to do with humor? And we don't think of that much of humor at all. If anything, this is probably an example of mass motor hysteria, something that we still see in this country, where a community can basically start showing signs that something is very, very wrong in their culture, in their community, through different physical manifestations, from crying or convulsing, or in this case, laughing. Was and it, that to me... Sorry, go on.
I'm just curious about this village. It was Nshamba?
Yes.
All right.
Nshamba.
People just laughed all the time? Were there other symptoms of this epidemic?
Yes, there were definitely other symptoms. There was crying, there was flailing about, saying that they believed someone was trying to chase them. Now, probably because the laughing part was the most evocative part, that's the part that it became known for. Mm-hmm. And that's what the medical journals of the times ended up writing about. And I think the laughter part is important because laughter has been shown to be contagious. There have been studies where we see these mirror neurons fire in our brains if we just hear the sound of someone else laughing. So just by hearing the sound of laughter, the neurons in our brain responsible for our own laughter end up firing. So there's something so primal about just the sound of laughter, it can trigger that in ourselves without even knowing what's funny.
Okay. Joel, we're going to take a break here. We'll come back and talk some more, all right?
Yes, please.
All right, yeah, please do. Please stay there. Joel Warner, standing by to talk some more with us about humor. This book that he and his colleague produced, The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. Two guys, 19 experiments conducted around the world on 5 continents, 91,000 miles. A global search for what makes things funny. And we're going to talk about Baltimore when we get back here. Do you think Baltimore is funny? Is this a funny town? How do you measure whether a town's... I think Baltimore is funny. I mean, I laugh all the time when I walk down the street. 410-662-8780. What do you think's funny about Baltimore? Huh? I'd like to hear from you. Oh, you think it's funny, do you? Do you? What's so funny? Give me a ring, 866-661-9309. If you're calling from Washington, D.C., that's a toll-free long-distance number. That's supposed to be funny. Washington, D.C. is supposed to be funnier than Baltimore. Do you believe that? I don't believe that. But we'll get back. We'll talk to Joel about it. Welcome back. Trying to break the humor code with Joel Warner and Peter McGraw. Joel Warner joining us to talk about the research of Peter McGraw into humor, his humor lab. This is at University of Denver in Boulder, where Peter McGraw is. Joel Warner's joining us here. Here's a question from one of our listeners. Did you and Peter in your travels and your research find any culture that just isn't funny, that just has no sense of humor?
No, definitely not. That I assume, would be a cultural impossibility. I mean, we all find things to laugh about. We might not agree on what those things are, but the very fact that we could find all sorts of humor in some of the worst parts of, say, Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, I mean, there were, it was funny, I found some news reports about a century old of this new civilization that had been found. I think they're called the Waletas, who didn't laugh at anything these explorers said, and that of course turned out not to be true. I don't think it's possible. I mean, how could you imagine going through life and never finding anything funny?
Yeah, it doesn't sound like much fun. But every culture is different, right?
Yes, and that's like every
yeah.
Everyone's going to assume their own culture is the funniest. I hope they do because it's based on their own assumptions about how they see life. So they should find their own culture the funniest around the world.
And you find differences in humor in, even in cities, from city to city in the United States. So this would be a good time, Joel, just talk a little bit about this system or these algorithms that Peter developed for determining funny cities.
So yeah, this began several years ago when I received one of those endless press releases about, you know, such and such has rated the top 50 healthiest cities or happiest cities or whatnot. I thought to myself, anyone ever done funniest cities?
Right.
And we couldn't find much. We decided, okay, well, then Hurl, the Human Research Lab, has to do this. So first off, you know, we're not saying these are the funniest cities in the world. We're saying based on the American concept of humor, this is how the cities stack up. And it was really hard because, first off, to think of how do you measure a place's sense of humor? Is it based on how people appreciate jokes in terms of how often they go to comedy clubs? Is it about how people create jokes? Is it something else? So the Hurl researchers spent 9 months collecting as much data as possible on everything they could think of, from comedy clubs per square mile to visits to funny websites, to quizzing traveling national comedians' ratings of different audiences in these different cities. And we took all of this information and came up with a list of the most funny, least funny, of the top 50 largest U.S. cities.
So it seems to be based on what the audience for humor is there, with the number of comedy clubs, if comedy radio stations, for instance, like that, comedians actually born in those cities?
Yes. Okay. Also, Google searches in terms of how many people are searching for things related to humor.
Okay. But, you know, I mean, I'd rather travel around America just sort of with an eye toward measuring whether I feel like a place is funny or not, whether the people talk funny, they are funny. When they greet you, they have a little joke or something, even if it's a bad joke.
Yeah, I completely agree. In some ways,
the hairdos.
Those
no, the hairdos can make you laugh. In Baltimore, I mean, come on. The hairdos can make you laugh.
And that's
the
why
tattoos.
What we did, because we couldn't do it for all 50 cities. It would just take years. But for the top 10 cities that we obtained from these objective measures, we collected online surveys with 900 residents of the top 10 cities and asked them more about this humor of daily lives, how they sought out humor in their daily lives, what their workplaces were like. We had them take a sense of humor personality test, much more specific about this kind of organic humor. And that's how we were able to not just refine our top 10 list, but it basically develop different humor profiles for the top 10 funniest cities.
And Washington, D.C. is in the top 10 and not Baltimore?
Yes, I'm sorry to say.
How did Washington get in there? What's funny about Washington? I mean, I guess you can look at it, you can say Congress is kind of funny, I guess, but I don't think anybody finds Congress funny anymore. But what makes, you're talking about the interest in comedy clubs, the fact that they have Capitol steps, is that it?
I think in some ways, as you point out, I mean, if you can't laugh at the mess of politics these days in Washington, D.C., I mean, what can you do with that?
I'm sorry. You got to come see Baltimore City Council on Monday nights if you want to get a laugh. All right. Let's go to the phone lines. More questions for Joel Warner about the humor code. Here's Michael in Baltimore. We welcome you to Midday. Hi, Michael.
Yes, good afternoon. I had a quick question for Joel concerning why much of comedy doesn't seem to age well. For instance, much stand-up and late-night comedy from the 70s, when we watch it now, it doesn't seem funny at all. Like Steve Martin with an arrow through his head, or Shields and Yarnell, or Gallagher, it seems to have like a moment, a place in time that doesn't extend much beyond it unless it's super legendary, like Lenny Bruce or something that transcends. And it's a lot of, when you look at a lot of this stuff, even Saturday Night Live early is not that funny looking back on it.
Oh, come on now. What, are you talking about the original crew of Saturday Night Live?
Well, that might have been a stretch right there. But
what about the Marx Brothers?
That's one of those timeless ones.
Yeah. Well, okay. That's in that category. I don't know about Lenny Bruce, but all right. Michael, but he has a good question there, and I'll let Joel address it.
Well, I think it's good to reference Lenny Bruce because even if you still think it's funny, at the time, the stuff that Lenny Bruce was doing on stage was so revolutionary. He was pushing the envelope in such an extreme manner. If we look at those same routines now compared to what a lot of comedians are doing these days, it doesn't seem nearly as extreme. And I think that's because
that's true.
The world of stand-up comedy is so topical. It's so based, I mean, and so much of it is based on what is going on at the time for the comedian, for the audience, whether it's about politics, whether it's about new developments in the culture. And so we're going to laugh the loudest, we're going to find the most humor in things that are directly relevant to us at a given time. Mm-hmm. And that's why some of the slapstick stuff, whether it's Marx Brothers or Charlie Chaplin, since it's more broad, it's more general, we still might find it funny now as we did, say, 70, 80 years ago, but we're not going to laugh as hard as we do as maybe a fantastic Louis C.K. routine or a fantastic Tig Notaro routine.
Okay, let's take another call. Chris in Parkville for Joel Warner. Hey, Chris.
Chris. I just wanted to make a comment about the 60 years ago, I took a 9-credit course, and it was all about humor, what made us laugh and what made us cry. And the thing is, it had one common denominator, and it was a deviation from the norm.
Yeah.
We all go on our merry way, and all of a sudden, somebody will do something that's different. One example of comedy is when Red Skelton had his old show. He'd always come out, and he'd trip and fall on the floor. So he did this for several weeks. Then one day he came out and he went up instead of down, and that was funny.
That's a very interesting. You know what you're talking about, Chris, is the situation having a violation. It takes us back to what
when you were talking about.
Yeah, benign violation theory, right, Joel?
Yes, and I think actually, in some ways, that's a reference to what's called the incongruity theory, which might be, for a lot of people, the strongest contender what makes things funny, that you're led to believe one thing and something else happens, and therefore it's funny. Mm-hmm. Setups and punchlines and jokes work for the system very well. So a lot of theorists believe this comes the closest to explaining what makes things funny better than, say, benign violation theory. And I'm going to say off the bat, benign violation, that's really Pete's bag. I think it's a good theory. I'm not going to say yet it's the end-all, be-all of humor. I will say, however, there do seem to be some problems with saying incongruity explains all of humor, because there have been studies that show that in humor, surprise incongruity is overrated. There was an experiment in the 70s that took a bunch of Bill Cosby and Phyllis Diller routines and found that the punchlines that were the most expected actually ended up being the funniest. So I think, in other words, we can't say yet this is exactly what makes things funny. I think all of these
some
theories,
don't
whether
find,
it's incongruity
they, some people
or
don't
whatever,
find
they all need more research.
Joel, some people don't find Monty Python funny, and that's full of incongruity, right?
Sure. And the other challenge with incongruity, it doesn't always explain exactly why humor can fail, what's not funny. I mean, there are a lot of surprising things, a lot of incongruous things that happen to us that aren't necessarily funny.
All right. One last thing I wanted to say about our last caller, Chris. He mentioned Red Skelton. Red Skelton used to do a routine called Freddy the Freeloader, who was, a hobo, a bum, who picked through trash cans and slept on park benches. So one day I was in a Staples store. They were selling Christmas specials, video Christmas specials, Red Skelton Christmas special from 1966. And I've got a little son. He's 7 or 8 years old. I think I'd take him home and show him what was humor when I was growing up, the Red Skelton show. And there he is, Freddy the Freeloader, and it's snowing, and he's on a park bench sleeping on the newspapers and picking through a trash can looking for a cigar. And my son's watching it. He's 7 years old, and he says, "Is this about a homeless guy?" And it stopped me right there. I said, "Yeah, I guess Freddy the Freeloader was a homeless guy. We used to call him a bum or a hobo, but yeah." And my 7-year-old son, who had already been, you know, trained to not find homelessness funny by that age, did not find Freddie the Freeloader funny as we did. Just shows you, this is an example of how things can change in a generation with the changes in norms. Let's take a call, Dion, with a question about children and humor for Joel. Hi, Dion.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. It's your turn. Go ahead and ask your question.
Okay, great. I'm a working mom in Baltimore, so I actually have audio of my son laughing to cheer me up sometimes at work. And I wanted to ask, I mean, as moms, we're always, and parents in general, we're usually looking for developmental markers in our kids of when they start to smile and when they start to coo and when they start to repeat words back to you. Were there any variations across all these cultures that you looked at with when we actually start to develop our funny bone?
Ah, good question.
Yeah, there has been research over the years looking at the different points that different kinds of humor occur. So, you know, the easier stuff, the physical humor, that comes first. The much more advanced kinds of humor, like sarcasm, it might not be until some kids are teenagers that people might fully grasp that this stuff is funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny about sarcasm is that it's so hard, especially in this day and age with, say, emails or whatnot, to detect sarcasm. Some people are pushing to create something called a sarc mark, which is a new form of punctuation. I'll say this is sarcasm, because it takes folks so long to develop the understanding of things that are supposed to be sarcastic.
Oh, that's interesting. Lee is calling from Baltimore, wanted to make a point or ask a question about sarcasm or snark, maybe. Hey, Lee.
Yeah, perfect segue. It's Ali, Sadiq Ali, to be precise. And I just wanted to make a comment really quickly before I get to my point. Like Dan, I've always appreciated your sly or your sense of humor of myself, so I appreciate it.
All right, Lee. Thanks.
No problem. But I guess my question is, you know, just really I'd be curious on your thoughts on, I guess, the inclusion or, I guess, the expansion or the increased, I guess, ubiquitousness of sarcasm in our humor.
Mm-hmm.
And I've kind of personally written blogs on the subject, et cetera, about how, I guess, as we see so much of our attention being turned to, I guess, what they call reality TV and some of these things that are based on humiliation and degradation, I've seen almost a concurrent rise with sarcasm. So I'd just be curious in your thoughts, like how much has sarcasm increased in our humor?
Okay.
And kind of what is that doing to our psyche as a people?
Ali, thank you for that question. Joel, could you be brief? We're about at the end of our hour here.
I don't necessarily think that we've seen more sarcasm, more satire in the humor. I think we're seeing more and more attempts at humor and more attempts shared on Facebook and social media. And so we might be seeing what looks like more examples of all these kinds of humor. And I honestly think that's a good thing. We only laugh a couple dozen times a day, which is down from basically a couple dozen times each hour when we were 5 years old.
Mm.
But I think we could all stand to look for and create and appreciate humor more in our daily lives.
I'm with you there. Thank you, Joel. So, okay, go out and tickle somebody you know. Not someone you don't know, but that'd be some advice from Joel Warner. Joel Warner with Peter McGraw have written The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. Their website is pretty funny, too. Take a look at that. There's a link to it on the Dan Rodrigues Facebook page. Hey, Joel, thanks very much. In regards to Peter.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Yep, thank you. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. Enjoy the rest of the afternoon. Tickle somebody you know. Have a laugh. I'll see you again tomorrow.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at wypr.org.